Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit by Louisville Public Media.
Welcome back to listeners. How are you? We're still in the midst of one of my favorite months, other than, of course, July, because July is my birth month. But October, the Halloween season, docked my mother. So, Chad, it was like 10 o'clock at night. My mother brings me, because I've been asking her, like, well, you know, we were kids, my mother used to always decorate for Halloween. Remember, you know, you heard stories
about your Halloween parties.
Yeah, when somebody came up to you on UofL's campus and was like, Jay's mom threw the best parties. So, but, you know, since our kids are grown, she doesn't really decorate the yard for anything other than really Christmas. But, okay. You know, but I guess she's gotten into the Halloween spirit because you saw that she bought my niece and nephew that big old pumpkin.
It's a doll. Yes. It's a huge pumpkin in front of your sister.
Yeah, well, they just moved around the corner.
Sister-in-law and brother's house, yes.
My mother went to Brown County, which is a place here in Kentucky that's like a big shopping, I guess, especially for seniors. And she comes back with this big, like, gigantic yard pumpkin. But I'll just say this. So she comes the other night with, like, a Kroger bag full of, like, Christmas lights, but they're Halloween lights. And she's like, Jay, can you please, like, decorate the awning? And I'm like, you know, it was like 11 o'clock at night and it was freezing cold. I was really happy that she's now in the Halloween spirit. So,
so cute.
Listeners, hopefully you are too. Anyway, let's get to it. So, Doc, it was interesting, like, twice in the past few weeks, people on Twitter have been like, oh my goodness, I had no idea that you all are based in Louisville.
I know.
And I'm like, okay, well, you know, we rep Kentucky all the time. You know, this is my favorite city and my favorite state.
Yeah.
But so we're going to talk a little bit more about Louisville because that's what I love to do. And so I'm super excited for today's guest who is a historian, is a local LGBTQ legend, and is a published author, of course. His newest book is called Secrets of Old Louisville. Please welcome to the show, N. David Williams. David, how are you?
Well, thank you, Jason.
It's good to finally have you. Now, as people in Louisville, of course, especially LGBT folk, know your name. You are the creator, I guess, our benefactor, our donor of the Williams-Nichols collection at UofL. What's the problem? Are you the donor, benefactor, creator, wizard?
All of that.
All the above. Yeah, all the above.
Yeah, I founded that in 1982. You know, the whole community has been giving us stuff.
Certainly.
Over the last 30 years or so. But, yeah, it started out kind of as my personal collection.
Okay. And by the way, it's a collection of LGBTQ memorabilia, documents, history, Louisville or the entire state?
Well, mainly of Louisville, okay. But also Kentucky. You know, I think it describes Louisville LGBTQ history better than any other middle-sized city in the whole country.
Absolutely.
You know, that includes Minneapolis, Indianapolis, Cincinnati. You know, whatever has happened in the last 50 years in our community, it's in there somewhere.
And you mentioned it started, like, kind of in your living room, right? Like, you kind of, did you set off some 30, 40 years ago, like, oh, let me hang on to these flyers, let me hang on to these buttons and T-shirts, or are you just like me and you're just a pack rat? And you're like, well, let me get these to the library.
Yes. No, I've always been kind of a pack rat. I get that from my grandmother, who used to collect all these newspapers and put them in her basement and forget about them. You know, she'd have newspapers from Japan attacks Pearl Harbor, you know.
Yeah.
This was like 1965. They were still sitting there, you know. So I kind of get the pack rat gene from her. And in 1982, when our community was starting to really get organized, all of a sudden all these newsletters and flyers and buttons and things were starting to come out. And so I thought, well, somebody needs to save these because otherwise they're just going to get thrown away. So being a natural pack rat, I just threw them in a box and put them on a shelf, you know. And that's basically how the archives started.
And that is so wonderful. And the archives are located at the University of Louisville.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And are they accessible to any and everyone?
Oh, yes. It's open to the public.
That's so wonderful.
I love it. Well, let's hop into this book, your newest book, Secrets of Old Louisville. And so it's arguably Old Louisville is one of the most famous neighborhoods, if not the city, within the entire state. And it's been the most written about, kind of most covered. But your book kind of pulls back the drapes, if you will. So Old Louisville, if you're not familiar with it, out-of-towners, it's a really diverse neighborhood, especially now. You may have one street that has old mansions that are now apartments, right? And then the next block over, you literally have the mayor's mansion. You have historic Central Park. It's a really, really beautiful, Doc, as you know, and diverse neighborhood. And so you're kind of pulling back, if you will, the shutters and the curtains and kind of delving into some funny stories, some interesting stories, some scary stories. But let's start at the top. Talk to us a little bit about the history of black folks, because we certainly know old Louisville to be one of the more diverse neighborhoods racially, economically. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. It's really fun to kind of just sightsee and people watch. But that wasn't always the case. As much of the inner city of what we know now as the West End used to be mostly white folks, right, David?
Oh, yes.
And then you had, of course, the white flight. But African-American presence in old Louisville goes back even before white folks kind of showed up. And what's now known as Simmons College mm-hmm. of Kentucky, their headquarters was there, yes?
Oh, yes, it's still there. Yeah, okay. It started, the building is still there. I think they're working on it to renovate it now. It was put up in 1879 over at, Fifth and Kentucky.
Seventh and Kentucky?
Seventh and Kentucky, yeah. So, you know, there's been an African-American presence in the area for quite a while.
Yeah. And you say in like in 1910 there were 600 African American alley homes. Mm-hmm. Now talk a little
bit. Yeah, what is an alley home?
Yeah, yeah. How is it different from the mansions and all those kind of things? Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, back when the neighborhood was being built on the alleys, they built their garages, which were carriage houses at the time, to house their horses and their buggies and all that. And then on the second floor, they built little rooms, or a couple of rooms, and that's where the African-American servants and butlers and maids, they all lived.
Okay. Mm.
So, you know, between Floyd and 7th, Broadway and Avery, which is now Cardinal Boulevard.
Okay.
There were about 600 alley homes. I call them alley homes. I don't know. They're carriage houses, but you know, I just came up with this idea because there were somebody's homes. And you know, they were probably pretty primitive.
Okay.
You know, they might have a coal stove. They probably did not have any running water. If you had to go to the bathroom, you went to the outhouse out in the yard somewhere. So, you know, it was pretty much the same as in slave days, except these people were not technically slaves.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just lived in the city.
Yeah.
So I had heard for many years that these carriage houses had been the home of African-American men and women and families. But I didn't really find out a whole lot about it until I started doing research.
Oh.
And it was quite amazing. You know, they were all over the place. Now, you know, let me preface this. I should have done this before. You know, as a white man, I feel a little skittish about writing about African-American history because the only people that can really write about African-American history is African-Americans.
Certainly.
As a historian, I'm a professional. I think I can do a good job, but there's insights that I might not have that an African-American historian would. So.
Some things might get lost in translation mm-hmm. and those yes. kinds of things, but I think you've done a pretty decent job.
I think so, too, and I really appreciated the part where you discuss in the book when you talk about these carriage homes, about how many Victorians in Louisville at the time in the early 1900s really couldn't get past the idea of a kind of plantation mentality.
Oh, yes.
What do you mean by that? Like,
well, you know, because take, for example, I ran across a story where one of the black butlers, he had to go to the bathroom, and he couldn't make it out to the outhouse, so he used the white people's toilet inside the mansion. And he got arrested.
Wow.
You know, it's just crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, people still have this patronizing way of looking at black people. So,
yeah.
Well, they're here. We've got to put up with them. You know, we'll put them to work, but we won't give them a living wage. You know, we're just
Common stuff. I mean, Louisville. I mean, Kentucky loves to point out that it was not a slave state, quote unquote. You know, but as we've talked about on the show in recent weeks about you know what Jim Crow and racism looks like in the North, and even though we're the northernmost southern state, some things about us are really southern, but some things we thought we had the certain northern sophistication, but you had redlining, and you still to this day see the remnants of racial segregation and kind of those kinds of laws that still are around and are affecting folk now.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's there's one African American professor at UK who has called it polite racism.
Yeah, polite racism, absolutely.
So that's kind of like it wasn't like whips and, lynchings necessarily and all that, but you know, it's probably the best way to put it.
Absolutely,
Still racism.
Yeah. Now, Muhammad Ali, one of Louisville's most famous sons, who we love, mm-hmm. He has some ties to Old Louisville. Probably the most infamous story that people love to tell about Muhammad Ali is how he kind of got into boxing. Uh-huh. And that's a story the legend goes that he had a bicycle and someone stole his bicycle. And then talk a little bit about that if you can.
Okay, yeah. You know, somebody stole his Red Schwinn bicycle, and somehow he got in touch with this man who was running the boxing program over at the Columbia Gym, which is now part of Spalding
University.
And
yes.
Muhammad Ali, who at that time was Cassius Clay.
And was a kid, yeah.
A kid, uh-huh. 14 years old, said he was going to whoop whoever that was that had stole his bike.
Yeah.
And this boxing promoter said, well, why don't you take that anger and channel it into boxing?
Yeah.
It'll be more healthy than going out and hitting somebody.
Yeah, especially if you're untrained. You might lose.
Yeah, yeah. You might break your neck. You know?
Yeah.
So that's a base. And that happened in what would have been part of Old Louisville at that time, the south of Broadway.
Yeah. And then also many, many years later, Muhammad Ali married Lonnie Williams, who is his most current wife, his widow. They got married actually in the heart of Old Louisville, 4th and Magnolia.
Yes, yes.
In the house of what was then County Judge Executive Harvey Sloan, who eventually became the mayor, two-time mayor of Louisville. Is that right?
Well, he was the mayor before then.
Okay, good.
Yeah, up until 1983.
And then became county judge.
County judge.
All right, awesome.
And that was his house. Yeah, it's a historic house of its own. And Muhammad Ali got married in the parlor in front of the fireplace.
All right.
Biggest ceremony.
That's a nice romantic situation. Doctor, you didn't know that the birthday song. Remember we talked about, I remember we were somewhere.
Yeah,
and I was
we were somewhere and Jay mentioned that the happy birthday song was created and originated here in Louisville, Kentucky. And I was like, oh, really? He was like, yep. And you mentioned this in your book of in terms of the music teachers who create the happy birthday song. But ironically, on her gravesite in Cave Hill, they don't mention the happy birthday song because it didn't become ubiquitous and all over until after her death. But talk to us a bit about who created the happy birthday song. How are they tied to Louisville?
Yeah, well, Mildred and Patty Hill were residents of Old Louisville at the time that they composed the happy birthday song. And I read something two or three weeks ago that the happy birthday song has elements of African-American music to it. Mildred Hill was a great early proponent of Negro spirituals and black music. And I mentioned in my book that it was probably kind of an amusing image to see a proper Victorian lady clapping her hands and tapping her feet to syncopated black music. But, you know, there was other people, too, like most famously Hattie Bishop Speed, who, you know, she refused to segregate her museum after it opened.
She by the way, founded the Speed Art Museum,
Speed Art Museum
here in Louisville.
Yeah. And Hattie Bishop Speed was also a big proponent of black music of that day. So, you know, it's something that a lot of people don't know about. The Courier-Journal mentioned at the time that black music was the weird of sound.
And
thought, well, if you only knew.
If only they knew it would become the most popular genre in American music this many years later.
Basis of all our music.
Yeah, the song was initially called Good Morning to All.
Yes.
Good Morning to we won't. Yeah, so one sister kind of creates the music. The other sister then creates the lyrics. That's neat. So where's the Hill House today?
Oh, okay, the house where they lived when they were composing the song was torn down about 1977. Oh. But now Mildred Hill's last home before she died is over here near 4th and Oak, and it's still standing. So so they ought to have a historical marker put
they
up
ought
there
to.
Somewhere, you know.
And they ought to give away, like, free birthday cake. I feel like every restaurant in the city should probably give away free birthday cake or birthday cake pops
in so
honor
too.
of the Mildred sisters.
But there needs to be some kind of marker or something in the city to
commemorate, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, there isn't yet. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's it's Halloween season.
Yes.
I don't like scary stories and murder mysteries, Doc, but you do.
I do. And I found the story in your chapter, The Murder of Jenny Bowman, fascinating. Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about what happened to Jenny Bowman and, you know?
Yeah, this it's a really troubling story on many levels. Jenny Bowman was a maid at a home over on Brook Street. And she was washing a goblet out when she heard a noise in the house. And so she went back towards the kitchen, and she spotted this African-American man, Albert Turner. And she asked him what he was doing in the house. He wasn't employed there or anything. And he said, "Oh, nothing, I just want to leave." Well, she confronted him and evidently grabbed his hand and started slashing his face with that the water goblet. And then he punched her, and he took a poker or a broken table leg and beat her on the head, and she fell to the floor and started bleeding. Mm. This was Albert Turner and his friend William Patterson were there to burglarize the place.
Mm.
And I don't think they realized that Jenny was at home at the time. So William Patterson came down the stairs and saw what was happening, and they carried Jenny Bowman's body up the back steps and put her in her bed. And William Patterson at one point asked her if she thought that she could identify them to the police. And she said that, yes, she probably could. So William Patterson, who was a real ruffian, he was, the police considered him the meanest man in town. He took a pipe and beat her on the head and basically knocked her out. And she survived somehow for 18 days, but not before she could identify one of the guys that had done this. So, you know, Patterson and Turner were taken to jail. The local sheriff, chief of police, realized right off that there was a potential for lynching. Mm. So he had them spirited away to Frankfurt for their safety. And then brought back the following Wednesday. Well, by then, white Louisville was boiling over, you know. Mm. Here was these two black guys that had assaulted this innocent white woman. And so they were out for revenge. On Thursday of that week, they tried to batter down the jailhouse door with a telephone pole.
Wow.
They were pushed back by a cordon of about 500 police. But then the crowd the following day grew to about 10 or 15,000 people on Jefferson Street in front of our courthouse.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, some of them had little one-foot ropes in the shape of a lynching rope to their lapels. And one guy had 50 feet of rope. You know, they were out to string these guys up in front of the courthouse.
Yeah. Vigilante justice is what they—
Vigilante justice. And the Louisville Legion finally came to the fore with a Gatling gun and pushed the crowd back, but there was 120 people arrested. It was the closest that Louisville ever got to a black lynching in Louisville. Now, ironically, before that, in 1871, there had been a white lynching. There's a white guy that was lynched for rape, but Louisville never had a black racial lynching. It was really an unfortunate incident. Finally, Turner and Patterson were found guilty and strung up legally, although some people say that it was a judicial lynching.
Yeah.
You know, they might have served life in prison if they had been white.
Wow. So,
it's a really, you know, I put this chapter in the book just to show that, you know, Victorian Louisville, it wasn't all tea cakes. It wasn't debutante parties. It wasn't people in carriages with parasols. It wasn't finery and, you know, grand architecture. There was a strong undercurrent of racism underneath Victorian Louisville. And I really think, I really hope that someday somebody with African-American studies at University of Louisville, or a sociologist or historian, preferably African-American, can dig deeper
into that particular story.
Yeah, because there's still an awful lot to talk about. This chapter is about 8 or 9 pages, but you could probably write a book about it.
Yeah.
What's the most interesting thing, your research about Louisville, what's been the most interesting thing that you've discovered? Is, you know, were there any salacious parties happening in these old Louisville mansions? Well, you know, debauchery, quirky stories, funny stories. What's been kind of some interesting things you've discovered over the course of writing this book and doing your research?
Okay. Well, I think the most interesting story was the story of Florence Irvin. In 1895, her son, who was 21, died at Tulane University in New Orleans. And she sought comfort in the arms of another man.
Unfortunately,
he was married at the time. And another thing, she was 57 and he was 24.
Yes.
So he was married to an actress. Eventually, he divorced his actress wife, although there's some evidence that they were trying to gold dig this woman. He was supposed to divorce his wife, marry Florence, and then they would be in cahoots to grab her fortune.
Mm.
Well, the wife eventually disappears, went off to San Francisco. But Florence and William Botto, her new husband, were married for 3 years. During that time, his mother moved into the mansion with him and started fiddling with the will.
Oh, wow.
And adding codicils. And so when Florence died in 1900, the relatives had decided that they were going to sue because there was something fishy about this will. And during Christmas time that year, the court ruled that, yes, the codicils were not in Florence's handwriting, and they tossed them out. So this was quite a scandal back then. Florence had decided to do this, to write this will, to write all of her relatives out of the will. She detested most of them. So that was probably the biggest scandal.
That's my kind of party, you know, shoot. I mean, the Victorians are living it up. They're murdering folk, and they were
single
folk husband and all kind of stuff.
They were real wild, yes.
Victorian cougar and marrying a 25-year-old kid, you know, so.
So tell us how our audience members can get your book. Is there a website?
Okay.
Is there spaces to order? Like, let us know how we can get our hands on it.
Oh, yes. Well, you can order it through butlerbooks.com. That's probably the easiest way. That's right here in town. It's also on Amazon, but it's also at Carmichael Books. It's downtown here at A Taste of Louisville. There's the Louisville Convention and Visitor Center has a lot of copies of the book. It's at Notorious or Unorthodox Books in Old Louisville. Or you can just email me. Can I say my
absolutely
email address?
Yeah. Okay.
And you get a copy that I can sign for you. It's kyartist21@gmail.com.
I love it. Well, I'll tell you what, David, thank you for being with us, making time for us. But more importantly, thank you for your many decades of service. I take for granted even because I think about things that were happening 20 years ago when I was a younger person. And particularly like the house ball culture, for example, Doc, and how like ball flyers and things that we kind of just threw away, right? That now there's a lot more interest in the house ball scene and people are trying to hunt down old videos. And so I really appreciate, David, that you had the foresight to think about like, yo, one day this will be important. And, because a lot of LGBT history in particular, whether that's because of the AIDS crises or because of any number of issues, homophobia, a lot of our history is forgotten and it becomes an oral history and it's up to folk like you to pass that down and preserve that. And so we're just really happy that you've done that.
We could probably spend a whole a program on black LGBT history here
absolutely
in Louisville and Kentucky.
Well, I'll tell you what. We're going to have you back sometime. Will you come back?
Yes, sure will.
All right. Again, listeners, this has been Ian David Williams, historian, author, all-around good person. The book is Secrets of Old Louisville. Of course, go online and Google, and you can find it anywhere. David, thank you so much, and please take care.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Jason.
Thanks, David.
Listeners, we'll be right back. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. This is Strange Fruit by Louisville Public Media.
On the new episode of Five Things, it's Idris Goodwin, playwright and artistic director of Stage One Family Theater, talking poetry.
And that's what I think all artists do, you know, whether they paint or sculpt. It's all just, you get into this thing of millimeters, that where it's like, no, let me say, I don't need that word, cut that word. You know, you're just trying to get it precise, you know.
The newest episode of Five Things, available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit by Louisville Public Media.
All right. So on to hot topics. Who's making headlines this week? Remy Ma. Of course, she made headlines last week and in recent weeks because she's been defending Bill Cosby. But of course she's been defending Bill Cosby. I'm not going to spend too much time on that. But she was saying something about, 60 women. I just don't believe them all. You know, so you telling me all sixty women were afraid to come forward, and so all the reductive stuff, but whatevs. But this particular thing that caught my attention, Doc, was that she was on a podcast called State of the Culture. It's actually a TV show, State of the Culture.
Okay,
and they were talking about a particular rapper named Lil Xan, X-A-N. Lil Xan, and okay. Lil Xan is like white Latino, so he ain't black. You know, he's okay. Like white and or white Latino type tease. And so Lil Xan was captured on video using the N-word. He got into an argument with someone in Indianapolis and was calling them, you know, like saying something, I got more money than you, my N, you know. The host, and these are all black panelists on this particular show, were having a discussion about how do you feel about people who are not black using the N-word. Now, listeners, if you don't know, there are two versions of the N-word. One is the traditional N-I-G-G-E-R, yes. Which we all know what that means, okay?
Right.
Pretty much always off limits. But then there is the more contemporary N-I-G-G-A. And I'm sure y'all have heard that, you know, that's the term you hear in your rap songs. That's the term you usually hear in your movies. Like, that's the, for lack of a better term, the term of endearment mm-hmm. that a lot of black folks use to one another. I mean, I use that term, in very specific ways, definitely on social media to relate a certain context, and maybe even among my friends. And so the discussion always becomes, can non-black people say N-I-G-G-A, right?
Right.
What if you're rapping Cardi B's song? Do you skip over that word? Are you allowed to say it? Mm-hmm. What if, can you say my ninja? Can you use some kind of equivalent? So Remy Ma says that she doesn't get offended. Regardless of what your nationality is, she does not get offended. She does not consider N-I-G-G-A to be a racial slur, as long as you don't mean it with any harm. She says, I hear it so frequently from people who aren't black. She says, like Fat Joe, the rapper Fat Joe.
Mm-hmm.
She says, like Fat Joe, he's the blackest Spanish guy on the planet Earth. And I've never questioned it.
Mm.
So Fat Joe, of course, is Latinx,
mm-hmm.
not black,
mm-hmm.
uses the N-word, because he's a hip-hop culture. Mm-hmm. Remy Ma's like, yo, he's the blackest. First of all, what is that phrase when people do that? When people be like, you're the blackest white dude I know.
It usually means that the person operates or performs or their presentation of self has some kind of relationship to a black stereotype. So either they're loud. They're late all the time. They talk in the movie theater. They eat fried chicken, whatever it is. But when black people say that phrase that, like, Bill Clinton was the first black president, they're talking about Bill Clinton playing the saxophone, smoking weed,
having swag,
and getting head in his office.
Yeah, basically,
So anything that sees blackness as buffoonery, coonery, that's what typically people
deviant,
mean.
I'm
really, really disappointed in Remy Ma because I adore her and Papoose. I adore them a lot. But, I mean, for me, I found that acceptance of the N-I-G-G-A word from brown folk, black folk accepting that use of the word from brown folk, typically on East Coast. So I do think that there's something about regionality, that like where what region of the country you live in and the closer proximity that black and brown folks have in those spaces. Whereas when we think about the Midwest and we think about the South, and even if we think about the West Coast, you really don't have black and brown folks in the same neighborhood, in the same circumference with one another. Whereas when you're talking about hip hop, you're talking about Boogie Down, you're talking about Bronx, you do, right? So every time I hear a black artist defending another non-black artist, but who is a brown artist, use of the N-word, they're always East Coast. So I feel like it has to do with some kind of the
regional
region. Now for me, no.
Yeah.
It's a no for me because, one, my thing is, what is the desire, right? So I get the whole question all the time, like, well, you guys use it all the time, right? So, like, my thing is, what's the desire? Like, do men as a group and collective want to use the B word?
Yeah.
Right? Do they want to reclaim that? Well, women say the B word to each other. Two friends can be talking to their women, and they say be this and be that. But what would be a man's desire to use a word that was once used in a pejorative way, and now women have embraced it and are using it as camaraderie and companionship, whatever they use it as, right? It's the same thing about the F word when it comes to that of gay men.
Yeah.
Me as a lesbian, I've never had any desire to say the F word, despite my close relationship to Butch Queens and black gay men my whole life, right? I've never ever once wanted to say it.
To be a part of that club.
I mean, and again, when the black gay men around me have used it, I'm not like, why can't I say it, right? Like, just like I don't expect you to be saying dyke or lezzy or anything like that. I just think that when it comes to linguistic reclamation, when it comes to terms that were used and invented to oppress and to hurt and to bruise, if that marginalized group that the term has been used against uses it and embraces that term and remixes it, imbues it with different meaning, right? So the N-I-G-G-E-R word was used for one purpose, right? Bruising, oppression, placement, you know your place, so on and so forth. When African-Americans have, as a community, have embraced it and used it to one another, we're not using the E-R, right?
Yeah.
So to me, somebody who's outside of that said group, their use of it, to me, is problematic because
Absolutely.
To me, it's someone in either a privileged space or not a part of that said history that wants to somehow participate in the exercise. And my thing is, why is that a desire of yours? Now, it gets tricky when you're talking about East Coast, you're talking about hip hop culture, and you're talking about MCs, artists, rappers, right? So Iggy Azalea, even though she's the protege of T.I., she was very clear not to use it, right?
Yeah.
But Fat Joe, right? So they're
and that's interesting,
you
too,
know?
About, like, about, yeah. So, but,
so
but
it's
I, but
a disconnect.
You're great, but let, I want to also talk about another story out of New York City. And I don't know if you saw about the Lyft driver and the Lyft passenger. Have you? I don't know if you saw that story. This
okay.
story broke about a week or two ago. But along those lines, there's a black man driving Lyft. He gets
okay.
two passengers. They're Puerto Rican.
Okay.
And there's some kind of conflagration that happens. Luckily, the Lyft driver, the black man, had a video recorder in his car.
Okay.
And he records this exchange. The two Puerto Rican dudes get in the car. There's some kind of falling out about the radio situation. The Puerto Rican dude begins hurling slurs towards the black driver, calls the police as well, insists the police come because this NIGGA is doing this and this NIGGA that, and you're racist. In fact, the passenger says that he's racist, that the driver's racist against gay people, okay? Because the passenger, okay, let me say that again. So the passenger who's Puerto Rican and gay says to the driver, you're racist against gay people. Right, but then begins to call him an NIGGA, and again, even though he doesn't say the ER, his use of NIGGA is used in a what am I trying to say? It's used in a way to like insult, right?
Mm-hmm,
you stupid
mm-hmm.
NIGGA,
right?
You know I'm gonna get you fired, you know, and so like, right, and so then of course, so again, a non-black person. Even though Puerto Ricans be having black roots, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't see himself that way. And so, again...
No, and there's a problem with, again, the Africanity. There are a lot of Latinx folk who don't connect themselves to any kind of Africanity or any African descent. And if anything, there's a lot of anti-blackness that happens in many Latinx communities. But there are some Latinx folk, right, who do identify as African diasporic, who will never use the N-word in a pejorative sense.
Certainly.
And will only use it with family, friends, and people who basically will not be bruised or, you know, upset
battered
by
it.
But, I mean, clearly this is not the case.
And this dude is like,
instance.
Oh, you know, he apologizes and says, you know, there's no excuse for the way in which he acted. But then he goes on to say that he's like, I'm Puerto Rican. I'm from the Bronx. I'm gay. We know discrimination, you know. So he's saying, like, I didn't intend. He says, I didn't have anything deep or anything in the back of my mind. It was not like that. It was just things I said because I felt some kind of way at that moment. So he's even acknowledging that in his own anger. Right, so again, because he gets to say NIGGA probably to his homeboys and everybody give him a pass,
mm-hmm.
in that fit of anger, he's reminded, you know, that he can also use that word in a hurtful kind of way. So
mm-hmm.
that's why I'm with you, Doc. It's never time
mm-hmm.
for white folk, especially non-black folk, and time for Asian folk, and time for nobody
mm-hmm.
who is not black and does not navigate the world as black to be used NIGGA. I'm just not with it. I mean, if I'm at karaoke and they say the N-word, child, cut the music off. Flash
oh, yeah.
lights, it's time
I mean,
to go home.
I feel the same way.
Yeah.
I feel the exact same way. And I do. I think that typically when you hear the rallying cry for, everybody can use it, it's a part of the culture, it's typically coming out of East Coast. And I really think that has to do with, again, Latinx, Black, and Asian influences when it comes to birth of hip-hop culture.
Yeah.
So those things become convoluted and much more murky in those senses when it comes to artists and you know, stuff like that. But yeah, nah.
Absolutely. Well, Doc, before we go, we had a great time at the great podcast crossover experience.
Recently,
the Beat 93.1 has a podcast, the Dr. Ricky Jones radio show. You and I were there last week.
Yes.
Had a great discussion.
We did.
We had so much fun. Talk a little bit about what we did.
Dr. Ricky Jones is my chair in Pan-African Studies. I mean, he's absolutely great. And he's been doing his radio show, his podcast on iHeartRadio for a couple of years now. And it's award-winning, just like ours.
Yes.
And so he wanted me and Jay to come on there this past weekend to talk about the Kavanaugh controversy, the Kanye controversy,
Kanye West,
and this idea of 45 saying that it's a really scary time for young boys and men,
yeah.
right? So we, of course, dispelled the notion that
manhood is under attack.
Exactly. And talked about, you know,
All kind of stuff. We're gonna give it away. Y'all can go. The link is on our social media. It's in our Twitter feed. We retweeted it. Go there. It's only 49 minutes. So you can go ahead and download that. After, of course, you listen to Strange Fruit. listen to us first. Yes. But then you have more time on your hands. Check out that that conversation. It was really, really dynamic. So thank you to Dr. Ricky Jones and Mr. 12, Mr. FTC for having us on the Ricky Jones Show. Well, Doc, we're out of time. Thanks to David Williams. That was a really fruitful conversation.
It really was.
White hysteria even back in the day. Mm-hmm. And even that story about the murder of the woman, the way it was in which the white mob mentality kind of existed back then, and who knows whether or not. And I love that David pointed that out. Like, again, if the lion wrote the story, the hunter would have a different perspective, right? And so what it means when white historians document experiences, right? And he's like, if a black person told the story, there might have been a totally different, perspective as to what happened. Maybe these dudes were innocent. Maybe they weren't. Who knows? But it was written in a way in which these black men were vilified. I mean, there are thousands of people in lynch mob outside the jailhouse.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually surprised and gagging a little bit that the judge in the case had enough foresight to move them to Frankfurt in the meantime, because, to dispel that, because that's the problem with the history of lynching in our country has been the complacency from law enforcement, from sheriffs, from townspeople, right? Because, again, these lynch mobs are not made up of this kind of uneducated, crazed crowd. I mean, there are people in these lynch mobs historically that were attorneys, that were judges themselves, that were lawyers, that were physicians, that were the people who owned the corner store. So they were just regular everyday citizens who felt entitled and arrogant and clearly racist enough to go and break into jails and not really even break in, but be let in by, again, sheriffs and deputies to come and string in this kind of vigilante, quote-unquote quasi-justice, right? Because we don't know, and a lot of the lynchings that happen across the country that were widespread after enslavement ends, we don't even know if crimes were actually even committed. So
yeah.
But nonetheless, I feel like that's why I really enjoy Tales from the Hood.
Okay.
And Tales from the Hood 2, check them out, because they really kind of... It's supposed to be this Halloween scary movie type thing, but they really deal with incidents of horror and fear and terror in black lives. So they deal with lynching, they deal with white supremacy and racism. So those are the things, right? So we don't really need ghost stories or, stories about witches or this and the third. I mean, literally in our history,
real life is scary enough.
Contemporaneously, yes. Yeah, we don't need to go to no haunted houses. I mean, nothing, right? It's right there in the historical record.
All right. Well, y'all, until next time, happy Halloween season. Just a few weeks left of the Halloween season. Hope y'all got your costumes. Doc, you have yours. We'll talk about it next week. We won't give away. And I have to tell y'all how I discovered Doc and Missy's Halloween costumes through a very interesting utensil that was in their bedroom.
Oh, my God.
That's all I'll say this week. Details next week. Doc, say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our editor is Laura Ellis. Our engineer is Kojin Toshiro.
For more information about Strange Fruit, visit strangefruitpod.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters.
Strange Fruit is produced by me, Kyla Story.
And me, Jason Gardner.
Thanks for listening.